Welcome to the EDUCAUSE Review Online Podcast.
Hi, my name is Ken Harbin. I am the president of Drexel University Online at Drexel University. Drexel University has a pretty large online degree program. We have over 100 programs fully online with about 8,000 students, working adults, who are in our program. And I'm joined by two of my colleagues from the field, Rob Wyatt. Rob is the director of distance learning at Western Kentucky University, and they have 20 graduate programs online and well over 5,000 students who are in that program. And next to Rob is Ann Taylor, who's the acting director of the John A. Dutton E. Education Institute at the Penn State University, where Ann, as a director, oversees seven programs that are online and thousands of students who are in that program. So welcome, guys. You know, obviously online learning has been around a long time. Going back, actually, Penn State was one of the first ones to have a distance learning program with correspondence courses and farmers out in the
1897.
Field. 1897. Right, right. Well, we've come a long way since that time. But and I think as of right now, in 2011, what do you guys see as some of the biggest challenges facing those of us teaching online and students who are learning online? We'll start with Dan.
Sure. I mean, we bring a unique perspective as a big research one institution. You cited the statistics for my college at Penn State, but the rest of the university, you combine us, and we're on our way to having our online students, our 100% online students, exceed the number of resident students at our main campus, within a few years. So really one of our biggest challenges with our faculty really needing to focus not only on teaching, which is of a huge importance, but also on research and service as a land-grant institution, is faculty capacity. Mm-hmm. As we continue to grow and really take Penn State beyond our physical borders, as we have been for since 1897, finding faculty who meet Penn State standards of the academic units, but who are new, most likely, because our existing faculty often, they can't take on one more thing.
Right, so it's really a scaling issue.
It's a scaling issue.
Rob, do you, same situation at Western Kentucky?
Yeah, but actually, in a way, I might touch on something she mentioned. Sometimes I think there's kind of an existential problem, too, challenge.
She
mentioned that the online side of it might overtake the regular face-to-face side. And then it's, what kind of university are you? Our university, about 15% of the credits are online, and we don't distinguish. Students can move freely back and forth between online and face-to-face classes. And I was asked during a strategic planning thing the other day, they said, well, how much are you going to grow this? And I said, well, how much do you want it to grow? 70%? Do you want it to become 100% online university? Is that what our, eventually if I grow every year, extrapolate it out, it'll be, is that what you want the university to be? And so I think as this starts to settle out, you kind of have to decide what do you want to be when you grow up and what kind of university do you want
to be? And I imagine that starts at the very top with the trustees and the president and the provost and all the way down. Would you see that as probably the biggest obstacle for growth? Is trying to figure out what you want to be when you grow up?
Well, the logistics, like she said, scaling and things like that, are things that usually can be solved, but you have to decide where you're going.
Right.
And so in strategic planning, every year they ask me how much I'm going to grow. And I said, well, if this goes on forever, you're going to have 100% online university. Then all of a sudden they look around and go, well, that's not what we want.
Yeah, that's not what we've created,
exactly. Right. So
yeah.
I think that logistic things can be solved, but and are definitely big challenges.
Yeah.
But you kind of have to decide what you want to be.
That's a great point. I mean, scaling is always, it's certainly an issue at Drexel University. By the same token, the quality piece becomes challenging because at many institutions, I mean, the reason why the for-profits are able to do what they do is because they've standardized their courses. And there's something to be said, I think, for that because we have some programs where you'll go online and the one class looks completely different from another class in that same program. So you end up playing, where's Waldo to find the syllabus and where the tests are located. Other programs have standardized it. Some programs are locked down. But then we get in the whole issue of, you know, academic freedom and some of the things that the for-profits don't have to deal with. But clearly, it sounds like, you know, there, in order for this industry to grow, and right now we're starting to see certainly some of the numbers we're looking at, Edge of Ventures reports only a 4% growth in online learning with adults. But, right. You know, I want to get back to, you know, what you see as what would be necessary, because everybody is talking about if growth is going to come, part of it is going to be more and more of these traditional age students who are looking to go into a fully or certainly a highly blended environment because either they can't afford to come to Happy Valley or they'll choose to spend that money as a graduate program at Happy Valley. As this industry of ours starts to move away from these adult learners and more into traditional age video playing kids like yours and mine who have grown up in that, what sort of challenges do you think that poses for universities?
That's not our focus at Penn State. Certainly, we're seeing a lot of traditional age students taking our courses, but we're absolutely not trying to replace that traditional college experience. So a little disconnect there just for us, because it really is the purpose of our World Campus really is new students. Mm-hmm. It's reaching those working adult professionals who couldn't otherwise come to our main campus. It's even the programs themselves are very different. They expect that someone's bringing life experiences and work experiences to their programs. But we work really hard to design our courses so that they would meet the needs of both audiences, because even a traditional adult student could still be someone who's very young, who just life took them in a different direction. Maybe they had a family early, or they went into the military, right. And now they're still very young coming back, and it needs to meet their needs too.
Yeah, well, talk to me a little more about both you guys about what constitutes that quality. You mentioned it's important, and my guess is a quality course is a quality course, whether it's an 18-year-old or 27-year-old. What, in your opinion, constitutes a quality course? What has to be a part of that?
Engagement. I mean, to have a course that really brings them in and you know, immerses them in the content and the subject and the discussion about it and its relevance. And I think that really is the number one, probably the easiest way to explain quality.
Good teaching's good teaching. I'm a big fan of the old Chickering and Gamson, you know, 7 principles of good undergraduate education,
which I think
apply to graduate as well. We have developed a lot of quality assurance tools at Penn State that we use, from course design standards to faculty peer review tools. I was lucky to have a part in developing that tool for our university. It's based on Chickering and Gamson. Mm-hmm. Good teaching is good teaching. So what we look for are courses that go through the same academic rigor as any other course and maybe exceed at our institution. And having those tools in place has really helped. I think the other key for us is faculty development. You know, in our country, and this is just kind of a beef I have in general, in my own higher education community, you know, in our country, we do a lot to make sure we train our K-12 teachers. We teach our teachers how to teach.
Right.
We don't do that across the board at the higher education level. So at our institution, we take faculty development very seriously. We don't mandate it as some universities are able to, but our faculty take us up on it. Mm-hmm. And it's usually under the guise, if you will, of, oh, I'm going to teach with this technology, so I need to learn. What we're really teaching is good teaching.
And a good teaching ultimately leads to high retention. What is it that Western Kentucky is doing right now to both monitor and report and intervene to raise the number of students who are succeeding?
Pretty much, yeah, you just did the initial triad. And there are a lot of metrics that have been developed in a lot of the LMSs and almost every single tool we have now that watch those, and then you turn those into early warning and response things. But I also even think that the good course design thing can actually help too. The courses that are well designed and you know, pertinent to the student will keep them retained and in the course a lot more than poorly done courses. So we are using a lot of the metrics that come along with a lot of the electronic tools.
For the online courses, the programs that our particular college offers, we developed a tool, web-based, that's just simply called Managing Your Online Course. And it walks faculty through the semester. We walk through it with them as a learning design group, but it's also a tool that they can you know, check, we even have a little postcard version, so they can make sure week by week, day by day, what could they be doing, what should they be doing, and make sure that they're really engaged with their students. We also share with them best practices and expectations for their online course, you know, give them good feedback, good faculty development, as we were talking about, about, you know, what is timely feedback? What is meaningful feedback? You know, how much should you engage? How much should you step back and not interfere with the learning that's taking place?
How do you benchmark? I mean, we all monitor this stuff. How is it that you benchmark your performance so that you know, well, we've got 70% or 40% or 50% retention?
The good thing is, and the very bad thing is, that since we're just starting, we're almost going to start off with, here's where we are.
Nowhere place to go.
Well, we could go down, but the goal would be to say, so we're actually going to start benchmarking ourselves, since this is still a relatively new business, and the comparisons have been all over the place, and the growth changes all those things over time, and availability of money changes all these factors over time. Really, the only thing you have to go with is you.
Is it fair to benchmark your online students against your adult learners, against your face-to-face adult learners?
I'm not sure that is.
How does Penn State benchmark itself? How do you know?
We're lucky. I mean, we have over 100 years of experience serving adult learners, and 13 with the online. So we certainly now have historical data that we can compare against, and compare against peers who are doing similar things. But I'm shaking my head about comparing against resident students, because it's really very different.
Yes.
Time to degree completion, totally different. An adult learner who is studying part-time at a distance is not going to finish a bachelor's degree in 4 years.
Right.
You can't fit it in.
What about
An unfair comparison.
What about adult learner part-time face-to-face versus adult learner online face-to-face? Is that closer?
That's closer.
That's much closer.
You know, something you just mentioned, here's an interesting thing, too. Face-to-face students who take a significant number of, let's say, more than 15 online credits finish faster than students who don't.
Wow.
At our university. And these are things that follow the metrics.
Right.
A lot of students use you have scheduling difficulties.
Right.
I'm trying to take 5 classes. I can't time footprint them all in. So I take 4 face-to-face, 1 online class, and now all of a sudden I'm up to 15 hours a semester, and I can finish in 3.5 semesters instead of 4.
Right.
Where before, physically, it wasn't possible to be in all those places at the same time.
Do either of you require online students to go through any sort of orientation prior to, or does that vary from college to college?
It varies from program to program. We have some programs that require at the beginning of the program orientation.
Mm-hmm.
One, for example, we have an online bachelor's program that has a 1 credit or perhaps 2 short course that introduces them to the program and also introduces them to the technologies that they're going to run into, be it the learning management system or be it something as small as Jing, a screen capture system, so that when they get into their courses and they're expected to use those technologies, that faculty member doesn't have to teach that all over again. Every course also has a course orientation that introduces, like, the first day of class, but also touches on technology as well. And that's something, as an institute within one college, we actually provide our faculty with a kind of a boilerplate course orientation that they can then modify so that they don't individually have to make that up every new course. And we have some standardization, as you discussed.
Yep, right. Yeah. Thanks very much, guys. And thank you for joining us.
You can find more audio and video on the new EDUCAUSE Review online magazine at www.educause.edu/ERO. I'm Jerry Bain. Thanks for listening.